Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and some of you may be interested in my television show tonight, where we will air, among other things, web video of Doris Lessing's unusual reaction to winning the Nobel Prize for Literature. That's tonight at 7:30 on CUNY TV, Channel 75 on the New York City cable systems. Well, right now, the friends and family of Jason Tirado are trying to figure out why the 25-year-old Lower East Side resident was shot dead by an off-duty undercover cop after a road rage incident last weekend. Officer Sean Sawyer fled the scene right after the shooting early Sunday morning, but he did turn himself in the next day. He was released soon after without an arrest. That's controversial. And Tirado's relatives are asking why. They are also asking why there was no breathalyzer test, as is now common practice for officers after a shooting. The Manhattan DA is setting up a grand jury right now. Al Sharpton is holding a news conference this morning about this. And the full details of this story really have yet to emerge. So with me now to break down what happened with what we know and to look at some of the culture clash that may be behind the shooting are Al Baker, police bureau chief for the New York Times, and Thomas Leake, also a reporter for the New York Times who's been writing on the cultural side. Al and Tom, thanks for coming on today.
Hi, Brian.
Al, please take us through the details as we know them now. What was going on between these two cars on the east side that led to the shooting on Sunday morning?
Yeah, it was shortly before 5 a.m. Sunday morning. Both cars, the victim, Jason Tirado, 25 years old, in a purple Honda Civic, southbound on the FDR Drive, approaching 116th Street. Behind him are two cars, friends of his, in a caravan. A police officer, an undercover off-duty officer named Sean Sawyer, is in a yellow Nissan Xterra. There's a motorcycle accident about 40 minutes before they get to 116th Street, and the cops are diverting traffic off the FDR. Mr. Tirado in his Honda refuses to let the officer merge off the highway, as we all know is a frustrating experience in driving, and that sparks a fight.
Now, Al Sharpton just held that news conference with the mother of Jason Tirado. The family denied that Tirado indicated that he had a gun at any time during that incident. Where does this claim of indication of a gun come in?
There's really two sort of ways that it happens. When they have an argument, when the traffic clears and both cars get off the highway, they spill out onto 116th Street and they're sort of headed westbound across 116th Street, and that's when there's some words exchanged between the two drivers, Mr. Tirado and the officer. The officer sort of giving the first indication of violence, indicating that he won't have, don't make me cap you, cap meaning shoot, and uses a racial epithet. This is according to a witness who's in Mr. Tirado's car, who the police have interviewed. So this is coming from a friend of the deceased. Later, the cars spin around onto northbound First Avenue, and according to the police account, Mr. Tirado pulls his Honda in front of the police officer's car and stops short, and now raises his hand up in the shape of a pistol, using his index finger and his thumb, making his hand into the shape of a gun, and just prior to that saying words to the effect of, "Would you like to see my new Ruger?" Ruger being a gun. Again, all according to the account of the deceased's friend who's sitting in the back seat. And that's where the prosecution is investigating the possible colorable claim of justification in the officer as the officer might have a possible self-defense claim, and it has to be explored fully precisely because, or more compellingly, because it is being made by someone associated with the victim. So that's where.
Before I bring Tom in and talk about kind of the two different cultures that met tragically on the FDR Drive, and we can also take some phone calls. I see people are calling in already, and anyone may call about this incident, which has been getting a lot of press, is 212-433-WNYC. Our number, 212-433-WNYC. 9692. How reliable are those quotes, as far as you can tell, attributed to Tirado's friend or carmate? Because I see in the article a law enforcement official is quoted saying that the undercover cop, Sawyer, made the first provocative, or the off-duty cop, Sawyer, made the first provocative comments. Sawyer said to Tirado, "Don't you know how to drive?" which was followed by the threat, "I'm going to have to cap one of you." And then he added the N-word, I guess Tirado did because the officer was black, allegedly. Sawyer, the cop, allegedly added the N-word. Although, is Tirado's not black, he's Hispanic, right?
Right.
So I don't know what to make of that. But, you know, you often have, I mean, you have in the Sean Bell case, a disputed claim of somebody appearing to pull a gun when there was no gun. So how credible is any of this that's coming from any of these sources at this point?
I think one of the things to bear in mind is perhaps that the interviews of the people in the car was done in the hours prior to the officer turning himself in. The incident happened at 5 a.m. on Sunday. The officer, as we know, left the scene. That is troubling to the police department brass, I would say. Only later, upon watching news accounts of what happened, puts things together in his mind and realizes he might have been involved in that shooting in which that man died. And then he leaves his home at 11 or so or 12 flags down a policeman on 102nd Street in Central Park West, flags down a uniformed housing police sergeant and his driver, an officer, tells them he feels sick, has chest pain, needs a hospital, and may have been in a shooting. So they get his, a story from him. He never makes official comments, the officer. He's taken to the hospital, and the next thing is that a police union lawyer shows up for him. Mm. But the story, the account of the witnesses, is obtained by investigators hours before the officer appears implicates himself in the situation.
Right. So he's not talking, but Tirado's family is, and using these reported comments. Tom Leak, this was a clash between two very different people, but they were also from two very different worlds in New York City. Tirado and his friends were apparently car aficionados of a sort, and they loved showing off their souped-up automobiles to their friends throughout the city. In fact, they had a regular meeting place, we're told, at the Dyckman Marina up in Inwood, which is a place where you can park a lot of cars. Officer Sawyer is a 35-year-old undercover cop with a wife and two kids. So how much of this is about a clash of cultures?
Brian, I don't know that I would want to speculate on that. I don't know enough about Officer Sawyer's background to even speculate that anything having to do with different cultures was on his mind when that night when he encountered another vehicle. The reporting we did on the young men who accompanied Mr. Tirado indicated that they indeed came from a very distinctly immigrant background on the Lower East Side of New York. They were longtime friends. Most of them had grown up in the Jacob Riis houses, large public housing project.
On the Lower East Side.
Right. Very much a shared interest in cars, as you say. They were pals, and they were out for a night on the town. In fact, they had commonly stayed out all night on the town, driving around, carousing, drinking. But when it came down to a confrontation on the FDR Drive or an exit ramp, I don't feel qualified to speculate how much ethnic backgrounds, race,
right,
any of those considerations entered their calculation.
Is it interesting to you that Al Sharpton, in the press conference just held, appeared with Tirado's family and other African American leaders, even though Tirado, the victim, was Latino and the officer is black?
Well, it's certainly an indication that these questions of race and culture are not so clear-cut anymore. They've become quite complicated.
Clarence in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Clarence.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I've never called before anywhere, but I just felt compelled to say something on this. I went into the New York City Police Academy in 2006 with all types of ideals and high hopes about what the police department was about. And I'm highly educated, college degree, graduated cum laude, and I constantly kept hearing people tell me, you know, this is not rocket science. You don't need a college degree to do this. And I was shortly horrified by the type of culture, as you say, a culture clash. There is a culture clash, and the clash is that I'm a cop. You do what I say. You do it when I tell you to do it, and don't you dare do anything to threaten my authority or my ego. And I graduated at the top of the New York City Police Academy. I was one of their top shooters. I had a 97% average, and I quit the day after graduation.
Clarence, I want to get a reaction and have time to get some other callers in, but I appreciate that heartfelt speak out. Al Baker, you're the police bureau chief for The Times. Do you think a lot of people feel the way he does?
I'm not sure.
Or the way he describes.
Well, it's an interesting perspective that he's talking about, and I'm interested. I'd like to hear more about his experience. You know, and I think your point earlier, I think Mr. Sharpton, in the case of the Bell shooting, has, you know, articulated that it is not a question of black and white, perhaps, but a question of black and blue, blue meaning police. Some of the officers in the Bell shooting, the one who opened fire, in fact, just guard as Nora, was an undercover minority black
and
man.
In fact, as you point out in the article, last job for Sawyer was working in hip-hop, and he joined the force relatively late in his life, and the Times account said he was made an undercover quite quickly because he was a minority.
Yeah, I mean, it is true that oftentimes that is dangerous work. It is work in which you have to mix in ways, so if you are young, as he was, he joined the force when he was 30, and if you are a minority, you might have success in the undercover path, which after having spent 18 months working in the very dangerous, very complicated world of undercover police work in New York, you will earn your, if you fill all the requirements, you'll earn your gold detective shield.
He's had 5 years total on the force. Joshua and Edison, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joshua.
Hello. I'm actually a law enforcement officer. One time I did have an incident that was sort of road rage. A man tried to follow me home. Apparently I cut him off. I didn't even realize. And it was very frightening. And just as a law enforcement officer, I have to say that we're not regular people. We are conscious of having a weapon with us. And sometimes fear steps in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for sure, I think road rage is something that every human being would describe as colorblind, perhaps. Being a policeman in New York City or a police officer, you know, you don't know what was in Officer Sawyer's mind. We don't know his story, and a lot of questions are unanswered. It would be very interesting to know, perhaps, what went through his mind. Did he think these were people he had arrested before who made him? It doesn't explain why he would leave the scene, though, I'm sorry to say. But as far as the fear that you speak of and being an officer, I'm sure that being a police, a law enforcement person, brings quite a bit of different perspective to these encounters you may have off-duty.
Well, than other person would have. Well, Nancy in Manhattan has a question about that reaction, I think. Nancy, you're on WNYC.
Thank you, Brian, for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
That is exactly the issue that I called in regards to. If you leave the scene of a crime, if you hit and run or you're drinking and driving, leaving the scene is an automatic no-no. For him to leave the scene and then come and return himself in the next day is appalling. African-American or not, I'm an African-American woman, graduated John Jay College of Criminal Justice. There is a code, there is this wall of blue. If you are a part of the blue wall, you are family. It doesn't matter what cultural background you belong to. We need to prosecute anyone who breaks the law.
Nancy, I'm going to leave it there for time. Thank you very much. Thomas Leake, you want to react to this at all?
Well, Yes, I think once again the caller brings to it a somewhat complex and sophisticated reaction. I mean, here there are lots of things going on the minds of that officer, and I guess only time will tell. It will take time to sort it out, I guess.
Right, and one of her questions was, why didn't the officer call for backup? But Anthony in Westport, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anthony.
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
All right.
My question would be kind of following up on what is going on there, but why would the police leave the scene of the incident and instead of say, okay, I left because I was fearful of what's going on, why you didn't take yourself to the nearest police station?
Right. Well, and in fact, when he turned himself in, he turned himself in to the PBA, which I guess gives him some prevention from other people talking to him. So how much is known about that, Al?
Well, he turned himself into two uniformed cops who took him to the hospital. Then the PBA lawyer came, and a lawyer would be available to anybody, police officer or not, in a situation like that. Why he left the scene, only he can tell us, and he hasn't told us. We really don't know much as we'd like to know.
There is another part of the story that relates to a recent change in police procedures. Officer Sawyer, and I want to clear up some confusion. Some listeners are calling in, not sure whether he was undercover or off duty, and the answer is both, right? He's an undercover cop but was off duty at the time.
Right.
But he wasn't breathalyzed after he turned himself in 19 hours after the shooting, so I'm not sure any alcohol in his system would have shown up. But should he have been tested under routine police procedures?
Well, I think that there is. Ray Kelly in September instituted a new policy, which is mandatory now, to have police officers who are involved in a shooting in which a bullet of theirs wounds or kills someone to be breathalyzed immediately on the scene. Without question, they cannot evade this. This is a new policy that's been instituted. It's been challenged in federal court by the police unions unsuccessfully at the moment after a week of being in court. But Kelly, after the Bell shooting, Commissioner Kelly impaneled 19 experts who came up with this recommendation, and he adopted it. The breathalyzer test is issued, I think, for its most practical effect in the immediate aftermath of an incident. Otherwise, it is of no practical value, either in court or administratively on the police department. Number one, the time has elapsed, in this case 19 hours, between the time the person allegedly did the shooting and the time the person turns himself in. Number two, a test 19 hours later would be compromised, any lawyer could argue, because of what the behavior in those 19 hours was.
Could have been.
Perhaps he leaves and goes to a bar.
Right.
Perhaps he leaves, goes home, and has a drink there.
And that has to be the last word because we are out of time. New York Times correspondents Al Baker and Thomas Leake, obviously details still emerging, and thanks for clearing up as much as you could about this murky incident that is captivating the city right now. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Nuala McGovern is the executive producer of The Brian Lehrer Show with Jim Colgan, Lisa Allison, and Priya George. That's Debbie Daughtry at the audio controls. Talk to you tomorrow with guests including comedian George Carlin. I'm Brian Lehrer.